The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I think maybe we should start, and then I think people are going to be drifting in as the trade panel finishes. But I want to welcome you all to this panel on designing international organizations for the 21st century. Nice small topic for the final session of the day. I'm going to introduce the topic, and we've designed this really to be as informal and as interactive as possible. So I'm going to begin by just introducing the panel and introducing the topic, then I explain the format to you, and then we'll open up for a discussion, and eventually we'll broaden the discussion to include everyone in the audience as well. The reason for holding this panel is, as you know, is the international community's need for effective international organizations has never been greater. I mean, over the last couple of days, as we've explored how international law has evolved over the past couple of decades, we can see how much global integration there's been, how the complexity of international problems is growing, and that there are more and more problems where it's clear that without international collaboration, the chances of solving the problems just get worse and worse. I mean, it's obvious in the economic area and the security area, but you can add in health. I mean, we've seen with avian flu, with HIV/AIDS, that those problems can't be solved without some sort of international effort. Environmental problems are another example of problems. However, at the same time that the need for international collaboration is growing, the confidence of the international community and the ability of the existing international organizations to deal with these problems and to create the mechanisms for solving these problems continues to decline. There's concern that the governance structures are out of date, undemocratic, and overly sensitive to the interests of the rich and powerful states, and unduly insensitive to the interests of poor and weak states. You can look at the UN Security Council and the debates about reforming that, the structures, governance structures of the IMF and the World Bank. And at the same time, ironically, even though these institutions are accused of being overly sensitive to the interests of the rich and the powerful, the rich and the powerful states seem to be developing, if I can overstate it a little bit, but in almost a contempt for the ability of the international organizations to actually deal with the problems that we face, and that they themselves are wondering about the need for organizations. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is a sense that these international organizations, not only are they not sensitive enough to the interests of the poor and weak states in which most of humanity tends to live, but also to other stakeholders in the system, particularly non-state actors in those systems. And one manifestation of that is the concern that organizations are too independent and unaccountable. And I mean, the debate has been most extreme in the cases of the international financial institutions and the World Trade Organization, but it's a generalized problem. At the same time, or on the other hand, that this has been going on, there's a concern that other forms of international organizations are too weak and ineffective to actually do the job that they're supposed to do. And probably the best examples of that of the World Health Organization and its inability to deal with problems, such critical problems that it faces in the health area, and concern with the capacity of regional organizations to deal with problems. And one can look at the concern about the African Union getting involved in Sudan and the problems in Darfur and how difficult that is. Other examples can be found in other regions. But a general sense that some organizations are just too weak and ineffective to actually do what we want. Fourth problem that seems to exist is a sense that there's lack of coordination, that there's almost a sense of incoherence in the structure of international organizations. That in some cases, there's overlapping and conflicting jurisdiction, if you will, between different organizations. And so there's a risk of getting conflicting and inconsistent advice and support from organizations. But also a sense that there are gaps in the jurisdiction and that there are important problems that should be addressed, but that no one quite clearly has the jurisdiction and the authority to deal with those issues. All of these problems lead to a series of questions. Firstly, do we have the international organizations that we need? Secondly, are the organizations that we've got reformable in ways that they can come to meet the problems that we've got? So in other words, another way of stating that question would be, can they be made more responsive to all the stakeholders in these organizations, and can they be made more coherent? Or do we really need to reimagine and rethink the kinds of international organizations that we need, both in terms of their functions as well as in terms of their structures, and who should be the stakeholders and participants and decision makers in them? That's the background. To address these questions, we have a very distinguished group of panelists who have approached these problems and been thinking about these problems long and hard from a number of different perspectives, both as practitioners and as theorists. We're going to need some more chairs.
Two chairs.
There's some chairs here. So to discuss this, we have, as I said, a very distinguished panel. I'm going to begin on my left and introduce everyone sequentially. You have in your program materials the biographies for each of the people, so I'm not going to give a long biography because you can read that, but I will tell you a little bit. On my left is Professor Andrew Strauss from the Widener School of Law. Professor Strauss teaches and specializes in international law, and one of the projects he's been working on, I think for a decade or so, is rethinking a key aspect of international organizational structure, and he's been working on a proposal for a global parliamentary assembly as a way of democratizing international organizations. That's Professor Strauss. Next to me on my right is Professor Jerome Levinson, who I think many of you know. Professor Levinson teaches at this law school. He's had a long, distinguished career. He was previously the General Counsel of the Inter-American Development Bank and a member of the Meltzer Commission, looking at the mandated by the US Congress to look at the structure of the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, and was the author of a dissenting report in that commission. Next to him is Mr. Adesegu Nakin Alukbadi, who is the General Counsel and Director of Legal Services for the African Development Bank, where he's played a critical role, not only in legal, but in strategic and senior management positions in the bank. Previously, he also worked as the first legal director at the African Export-Import Bank, which is the African Export Credit Agency. Next to him is Mr. Jonathan Free, who is the executive director representing Canada and the Caribbean states, and I'm forgetting one, and Ireland, at the IMF. Previously, he worked in senior positions, in policy-making positions in the government of Canada, and Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, is the equivalent of the National Security Advisor for the Canadian government. Next to him is Mr. Aldo Cavieri, who is a distinguished alum of the law school, who's been working for a number of years on the Rethinking Bretton Woods project at the Center of Concern, and has been a leading NGO activist looking at how to rethink international organizations to make them more coherent, particularly in the economic area, working particularly on the financing for development initiatives that grew out of the Monterey Conference, which was, I guess, about 5 or 6 years ago at this point. So that's our distinguished panel to look at these issues. What I decided we would do for this panel is that the format we would use is I sent each of the panelists a set of questions, which I'm going to read to you now, and which I have on a sheet of paper, and I'll pass these around so you can have them with you. And that rather than have formal presentations, we would have this as a general discussion, with people just engaging in an informal discussion. Seeing we have some official representatives of organizations here, I want to make clear that this is an unofficial, informal discussion with Chatham House rules governing the discussion, so people can feel free to be as frank and as creative as they would like without fearing that this could come back to haunt them. What we'll do is after we've had the discussion, we'll open it up for a general discussion, including everybody. So as you can see, the six questions I asked the panelists. First one is, what role should international organizations play in global governance in the 21st century? Secondly, what role should states play in the governance of international organizations? And then third, what role should non-state actors, both legal and natural persons, so both NGOs, corporations, and individuals, play in the affairs of international organizations? Thirdly, to ask the question in a sense that I led off with is, do we have the international organizations that we need for both global economic governance as well as for ensuring peace and security in the 21st century? And the last question, seeing we're an audience of lawyers, is does the currently applicable international law adequately regulate international organizations? And if not, what are the major deficiencies and maybe how can we correct those deficiencies? By agreement, we agreed that I would invite Jonathan Fried to speak first to the first question as a way of opening this discussion, and then just encourage other panelists just to jump into the discussion and keep it as free-flowing. And my job will just be to make sure we cover as many of these questions as possible. So, Jonathan.
Well, thank you, Professor. Let me start with a slightly different premise than your setup, and that is we are and will for the long foreseeable future continue to live in a world of nation states. We will still have for some time to come a world where, consistent with the principles of international law that you've studied, sovereignty rests at the national, not the international level. That's overlaid in the post-war period with the sense of democracy and human rights, and thus each government is supposed to represent the will of its population. Thus, at the international level, in effect, the role of international organizations is, to put it very simply, that which is delegated to them by sovereign states. And by analogy, for those of you educated in Western political thought, to domestic political theory, the delegation is with the consent of the governed and for limited purposes. And thus, nations, when they get together, decide we would like to pool our sovereignty for certain limited purposes in this area or that area. For security, we'd like the United Nations, and we'd like to elaborate that in connection with regional organizations. I see we have the OAS represented here for collective self-defense. For the economy and for development, we've agreed among states to create a constellation of institutions, the WTO, the Bretton Woods institutions, regional organizations, and so on. And as Professor Bradlow pointed out, for other limited purposes, often sectoral, we've created very specific institutions, UN agencies, for example, World Health Organization, United Health Organization, and so on. All international organizations, by their constituent documents, treaties, the Articles of Agreement, as they're called, at the IMF or otherwise, derive their authority, their legitimacy, and their mandate from that which is given to them by the sovereign state. The system, therefore, is largely what you might call intergovernmental rather than supranational. Basically, nation states say, together, we will continue to act as owners, as shareholders, and act collaboratively on a more horizontal basis. We've really only delegated upward supranational authority for very limited purposes. The Security Council only when it acts under Article 7, for example. But what Professor Bradlow has posed as a question, and I'll be provocative enough to push back, is if you line up the international authority that's been delegated up on the one hand and national authority on the other, if you believe a nation state properly constituted, reflecting basic now universal principles of democracy accountability to its own citizens, the traditional view would be the nation state and its government representatives are the ones who will broker the national interest by properly engaging civil society, other stakeholders, sorting out the national interest, which is meant to be the ultimate settlement of differing views. That is what is brought to the international table. And if we feel that we're participants in a democratic government, that's a small v, I'm not playing American politics here, that we legitimately are partaking of democratic governance at the national level. We have entrusted our representatives to take that national view to the international level. On that model, it's sort of inconsistent to have both sovereign representatives as the co-owners of international institutions on the one hand, and non-governmental people on some sort of equal plane also represented, because that's all being sorted out at the national level. Now, various organizations from the UN to the World Bank have developed consultative mechanisms for consulting with parliamentarians. There is a World Bank Parliamentary Assembly. The United Nations has a network for doing similarly. But there, too, you're engaging on a theory of universalization of democracy with the legitimately elected representatives of the population. That's of a different notion than non-governmental representatives. I know Aldo will have something to say about that in response. So ultimately, the role of international organizations, just to start things off and come full circle, is that which countries want it to do. We want the pooling of sovereignty for security. So we have a UN and a Security Council and regional organizations. We want the pooling of sovereignty to better promote the economy globally and develop globally. We have a constellation of institutions for that. And we want to pool sovereignty for various global public goods, and we've created very specialized organizations to do that. You can't mail a letter without having an international postal union to get your letter across countries, and it's only by mutual agreement that we have an international body that enables international communication to take place by post, the International Telecommunications Union for Electronic, Aviation has ICAO, Maritime has UNCLOS and the Law of the Sea, pretty well universal except for the seabed. The United States recognizes the Law of the Sea framework, and so on. So all of which is to say, in answer to the first question, international organizations should play the role that countries want it to play. And to anticipate the later discussion, countries should bring to that international table that which their societies collectively want them to take to the international.
Thank you. Would anyone like to respond? Sure, Andy.
That was, I think, very interesting and, as you promised, provocative. I guess the part that I would take the most exception to, I think, Jonathan, is the what was implicit is that this is basically a democratic system. That the interest that having that the extent that countries are democratic, which of course is highly questionable in many situations, but that to the extent that countries are democratic, they are democratically delegating powers to the international, to their own governments, who are representing the sorted through, I think was your term, national interest at the international level. And I think that's really a heavily ideologically laden statement. I think it's convincing to people because we're so used to sort of thinking in certain ideological contexts, but it doesn't stand up very well to scrutiny about what's actually going on at the international level. And I think that's in a couple of different areas. First, I think that if you actually look at what's happening internationally in terms of the intergovernmental process, it's highly undemocratic because we have certain governments that are so, certain nation states that are so powerful, and the system isn't set up to be democratic between countries. So if you happen to be an American citizen, having the country, assuming for the moment that you're correct that it does adequately represent American citizenship, but if you have at the international level, American citizens are so disproportionately represented compared to mid-sized countries or poor, powerless third world countries, because of course you leverage not only the size of your population, but your economy, your military power. It's essentially a system, instead of being what we would recognize in the domestic context as a system of checks and balances and democratic processes, I've sometimes thought of it as more analogous to, and I don't mean this to be sarcastic, more analogous to a crime family system, really, where you have, you know, a bunch of criminal families meeting in some sort of syndicate, and saying, this is what, you know, you have to do, or else ultimately we can use military force against you. So I don't see the system being democratic in the sense of really the way we normally think about it in domestic context, is giving everybody, at least in theory, an equal opportunity to speak. And I think that the proof of that is, without being so ideologically laden, it's the feelings that are existing in the world today that we're living in. The fact that so many people feel so alienated, so powerless, that they feel like the system just has, that their voices are not being heard at all in the system. So I think that that's the main way it's not democratic, but I'd also just very briefly like to take exception with this idea that, you know, NGOs perhaps should be left out of the system, that they should or shouldn't be put on some sort of, I don't know, equal playing field, but some sort of voice in the system, because it leaves out the participatory element otherwise of what we regard as normal democracy in the domestic level. It's giving, if you believe in the theory of checks and balances, it's giving those who have influence to the highest levels of power at the national level incredible leverage to make their interest heard internationally, and especially if you can leverage that power in a country like the United States, or a country like the United Kingdom, or a country, for that matter, like China, some of the big players in the international system, allow for influential interests to have tremendous voices, and for the rest of the world to be largely silent. So I think in the way it actually comes out, it doesn't even begin to meet what we normally think of as democratic criteria.
Jerry, just before you talk, I know we're overflowing in every direction. The only thing I can suggest is, if people want to stand along the side here, you might be able to see better.
Okay.
There's a table over there and a table over here that you could come and sit on if you you're okay. Jerry.
Well, I think we're off to a good rocket start, and let's hope that I can continue that. It seems to me that what we're seeing now is the collapse of the theoretical foundation, which is governed really in both the post-war era, but more particularly in the last 20 and 25 years. We had a clearly defined role for the World Bank and the IMF during the crises, financial crises of the 80s and of the 90s. And we had a clearly defined, I think it's not too much to call it ideology or theology, which these institutions followed, summarized famously or infamously, depending upon your point of view, in the so-called Washington Consensus. Namely, that the road to development was through market allocation of resources, privatization, and reliance upon private foreign and domestic enterprise as the engine of development, and an open trading and investment regime. And those are the conditions which accompany World Bank and IMF financing, really, through the decades of the 80s and through the subsequent financial crises in the 90s, which hit countries which would formerly be considered the stars of the system, the East Asian countries. That, I think, has now all collapsed. And it leaves these institutions, the Bretton Woods institutions, right? Although I think crisis is an overused word here in Washington, I think it's legitimate to raise it in connection with the future role of these institutions. Because what is their role? In terms of providing capital for development, there are now alternative sources of capital. More advanced developing countries have direct access to the financial markets. You have new actors, China, investing in Africa and parts of Latin America to develop resources, not just the mines, if you will, to build the railroads, build the ports to get the goods out into the market. Chavez in Venezuela, or whatever you think of his ideological purpose, nevertheless, an important source of capital for Bolivia, Ecuador, Nicaragua, completely different the conditionality or the conditions, right, if there are conditions, couldn't be more different than from the World Bank and the IMF. In other words, a very different, what, instead of a single road to development, you now have multiple strategies of development, ranging in Latin America from Kirchner in Argentina and Lula in Brazil to a rather moderate social democracy to more radical social change, social and political change fostered by Chavez, and where nobody knows really where Bolivia, Ecuador, and Nicaragua are going. So what we have is a breakdown of that dominance, not only both in terms of source of capital, but in terms of the philosophy which accompanied. And we now have that there is no, we had Ana Palacios yesterday, General Counsel of the World Bank, speaking, and she referred to the World Bank as a knowledge bank. But what knowledge? When there's no consensus about the knowledge of best practices, what does that mean in the current world today? Now, the issue that is now, it seems to me, going to dominate is the degree to which the international institutions, the dominant countries, are going to infringe upon domestic decision making. We saw that with the World Bank and the IMF, which laid down this mantra of privatization, so that the question of public or private sector was no longer one for domestic decision making. What was one in which the international community said, you want financing, this is what you have to do. The World Trade Organization, the impasse over supposedly agriculture. But behind that, it's the question of political and social stability. Does anyone seriously believe that Korea and Japan are going to subject their small farm rice economy to the competition of the Louisiana rice plantations and thus undermine a foundation of their political and social stability since in the post-war period? So you're talking about the international community through these institutions now invading space which has been traditionally considered for domestic policy resolution. We see that also in the area of human rights. The area that was opened up by the arrest of Pinochet, the question of how far the international community is going to invade domestic political space in terms of, in the name of human rights. The Milosevic trial in Hague, Pinochet arrest in Great Britain. So I think we have a fundamentally different situation. I would take issue with Professor Strauss as well in terms of this sense of powerlessness, which it seems to me is too general. What we saw in the negotiation in Cancun was that a group of the so-called developing countries, admittedly the more we call newly industrialized countries, formed a bloc of 20, which brought the negotiations to a standstill. We see that although it's not quite clear how far it's going to go, special and differential treatment for the poorest countries, which have not had the same cohesion and thus ability to assert themselves within the trading regime, but an increasing realization that there has to be a differentiation, so that the degree of powerlessness, which previously might have been generalized, it seems to me has to be differentiated, because you can't say that China, Egypt, Brazil and India are powerless in the international arena today, particularly with respect to economic decision-making. And this creates a completely different situation. China can offer financing to Darfur and undercut every initiative to put pressure on Darfur. China can offer financing in Asia and in Africa without any of the conditionality of the World Bank. Chavez provides financing to Ortega in Nicaragua and says, don't worry about oil, we'll take care of it. and will also provide financing for major infrastructure projects, and also for Evo Morales' initiatives in adult literacy, education, and healthcare in Bolivia. So we have multiple now sources of financing accompanied by completely different philosophies. And therefore, it seems to me we're in a very new situation. What I don't see, and this is another, I'll finish, that what I don't see is that the existing institutions have come to terms with these changed circumstances at all. We don't hear from Wolfowitz any idea how the World Bank fits into this new panorama, or from, frankly, the IMF leadership. So it seems to me we have an intellectual vacuum.
I'm taking it looks like you were saying me next.
Well, I'm not going to speak for the IMF, not at all. But I think that the legal premise that international organizations have become defective or deficient or dysfunctional needs to be examined very, very carefully. Now, as was stated by Jonathan earlier on, international organizations are not institutions of general competence. They derive their authority from the instruments that establish them and from the authority that has been handed down to them by their members. Now, the key question is, are they properly situated to meet the challenges of the 21st century? Can they adapt to the new challenges that are facing international organizations in the 21st century? Now, as a practitioner and a general counsel of one of the international organizations, I can say that my experience over the years is that in spite of the constraints of the statutes, we have tried to be creative in applying the provisions of the charters of these institutions so that we can respond to new challenges as they come. In the particular context, as you know, particularly in the context of Africa, the key question that is facing us is poverty reduction. And the question is, how do we make our institutions in Africa effective so as to reduce poverty on the continent? Now, we went through an amendment process in the 1990s that was meant to reposition the institution to make it more to enable it to deliver effectively on the ground to our clientele. In essence, what I'm trying to say is that it is not necessary to dismantle the current institutions in order for them to respond to the challenges that they will have to face in the 21st century. Perhaps it is better to look at the possibility of adapting the current structures to make them more responsive rather than dismantling them.
Albert, yeah.
Maybe, also some controversy on some of the initial statements made by Jonathan. Leaving aside for the moment the issue of the NGOs, which I will come back later, but I want to pick up on this idea you threw, which was this idea that states that international intergovernmental organizations derive their authority from governmental delegation, which in theory I think we could still say it holds, but let me just, I think there are some evidence that this premise is beginning to fall down. No? And if you look, for example, at, and I think the key point where this premise really breaks is at the level of international organizations' interpretation of their own charters. You know? We don't have a mechanism at international level where the interpretation of its charter by an organization can be brought to another instance. You know, basically, at the end, it falls on the organization to say how much it can do or how much it cannot do. And you know, this, for example, has meant that for years the World Bank said we cannot do anything about corruption, then suddenly they said, oh, we cannot do anything about governance. At some point they decide, oh, okay, we can. You know, there are several, I think with the IMF it's also, you know, you have the same situation with the IMF going into areas where before it said it couldn't go. Now, you think the members who gave, you know, the states that gave that authority to the organization in 1945, were they having in mind these changes? Were they having in mind that this is the way the charter should be interpreted? I doubt it. And now, you could say, why don't they leave? Okay, because you could argue okay, they don't agree with how the authority delegated has been interpreted. Today they would leave. Well, the costs of leaving these organizations is so high that they wouldn't do it, right? So there are realities that really have led to organizations being able, I would say, to acquire some life of its own. And just as you have organizations interpreting charters, you also have organizations interpreting mandates, right? And so the big issue now in the UN, for example, like 5,000, I don't know how many mandates the organization has, they're trying to streamline that. And, you know, and the question, mandates older than 5 years or all the mandates. So in the end, whatever the decision is, I doubt that any member state, even if they are in disagreement with what is decided, they will be able to leave the Europe. Right? I mean, they might want, but, you know, they cannot, you know, the cost is just too high in today's world. And you have also, on the other hand, organizations that have been empowered by member states to do something that are not doing, you know? Like, you cannot go to any World Summit today where there is a mention of the Economic and Social Council of the UN, and the big need that there is to reinvigorate it so it can play its coordinating and role to achieve coherence in the international system. Now we go coherence and coordination of international economic and social policies. Go ask any of the organizations that are dealing with economic policies, including the IMF, how much you are coordinated by ECOSOC, for example. You know, and the answer is probably be a little above that, right? So this is an average, you know, states that gave authority to some of these organizations. The organizations are not performing. So what is the delegation of sovereignty there? And I know, you know, many governments that, you know, why don't we have a mechanism to sunset organizations that have played a role already, right? That, you know, because if really sovereignty is delegated for a limited purpose, and we would say for a limited time, right? Once the function has been dissolved, the organization should be able to dissolve. How many international organizations have been dissolved since 1945, for example, of all the plethora of organizations have been created? I don't think there is any example of organization dissolved. And I know of states that would want to dissolve, you know, states that tell you UNTA, for example, shouldn't be there anymore. Why is UNTA around? It's not something I agree with, but I'm just trying to make the point. Some states really don't agree with the very existence of organizations to whom they have delegated authority. So in this sense, it seems to me the premise of organizations really still deriving their authority only from the delegation from sovereign states can be called into question. And just when I really agree with the premise, you know, I'm just trying to make. I do agree that we still have a world that is state-centric in many ways. I think we still continue to have it for a long time, but we do have this trend towards international organizations acquiring a life of its own, and how we balance this tendency of international organizations to evolve sometimes in parallel and sometimes maybe at cross purpose with what their space has created and wanted them to do is something that will be a key challenge for the 21st century.
Just to add as a footnote to that, because I mean, oftentimes when we think of autonomous international organizations, we think of the World Bank, the IMF, and the other multilateral development banks, and think that they're the only ones that have autonomous positions in the sense that their work impacts directly on the citizens of those countries. But if you look at the UN system, particularly as failed states become a bigger issue, I mean, the UN in Haiti, in Kosovo, in Timor-Leste, and you could probably go on Namibia, has really taken on major governmental functions without having in place any of the kinds of mechanisms of accountability that, for one thing, the World Bank or the multilateral development banks have, let alone what they're demanding of their own, what they demand under human rights law of their member states. And so as we keep this discussion going, we should keep in mind we're not talking just about economic institutions, but really a much broader range of institutions. Jonathan?
Well, just to keep being provocative and to push back a bit, because people want to put me in a little right-wing corner here, and I'm actually still one of the most naive, idealistic, pro-poor, pro-development people around. And let me explain that. First of all, the notion of the entire international system being power-based, I think, is belied by the reality. If there's one equalizer for power, it's rules. And if you take a small country like Canada,
$30 million versus $300 million right next door, with all of the economic leverage and potential military leverage the United States has. For all of our history, we have found that turning to an international framework, being able to rely on the rules, is a great equalizer. I think that's been true of much smaller states as well. Antigua has succeeded in the WTO in taking on the United States and has got a ruling in the appellate body ruling in its favor, just to take another example. One has to weigh whether the kind of implicit leverage that was implied earlier is actually played out, or whether, in fact, if you have an effective rules-based framework, it actually keeps the otherwise powerful in their place. The other thing to keep in mind is it's not often played out, and let me talk very much about the real world here, as sort of the United States or China versus the little guy. There are caucuses. There is grouping. There is the assemblage of bargaining weight among regions, among states of different interests. If you review the literature, which is extensive, on the history of the law of the sea negotiations, for example, it wasn't developed versus developing, or American versus the rest of the world. It was coastal states, fishing states, landlocked states, island states, so on, each having a countervailing weight, and sometimes negotiations actually play out that way. Second quick point, I didn't mean to overstate the role of the citizenry. I said they're not on the same podium. They're certainly not to be excluded. I think the UN system of official observer status is tremendously useful. But I think there is a difference between a parliamentarian, to use a generic term, and a non-governmental person on the diets. The suggestion from a number of the panelists has been the consensus has broken down on the economic side. We don't know what we're doing, or there's all sorts of competing philosophies on development. Actually, the world's gone completely the other way. The definitive statement signed by 190 leaders of the world is called the Monterey Consensus, not the Washington Consensus, adopted in 2002. By the full support of the developing world as well as the developed world. It is very much a compact that, in effect, says we're all pro-poor as well as pro-growth. The only way you're going to have sustainable development is to generate wealth. You can't argue about dividing an existing pie. You have to make the world's pie bigger. How are you going to do that? You're going to do that by unleashing entrepreneurship wherever it can be found. You're going to do that by having an economy that generates enough wealth so that you actually have money to spend on health, education, water, capacity building, and so on. How do you do that? First of all, you do it with good governance. You have a finance ministry that knows how to run a budget and manage its debt and give them the appropriate debt relief to make sustainable budgeting possible. The developed world, for its part, has to live up to its promises for a steady stream of official development assistance. There has to be an equitable trading order. There has to be an environment that's hospitable to doing business and investment, and that helps the little guy. It's not to make the world safe for multinationals. It's to actually help somebody who's going to be small business at home. This is a global consensus. The United Nations General Assembly has asked for a review 5 years later on Monterey Plus 5. That'll likely turn into a summit. It's actually played out in practice, and you may wish to comment, in the NEPAD context, in the New Partnership for Africa's Development. In effect, it's a basic bargain. We, the developing world, do want to create that environment that's hospitable to development and growth. We promise good government, accountability to our citizens, consultation with civil society and mapping out our development plan. If you, the rich guys, promise to keep aid flowing, to keep your markets open, and to do the appropriate debt relief. So there actually is even more consensus than there's ever been. In terms of the role of the bank and the fund in that context, I wish it's not legal material and it's not readily available, but frankly speaking, for the IMF, the managing director has been very articulate and very clear on what the fund has learned from its past mistakes in the 90s. Its mandate is very limited and very clear. We can teach you how to build a finance ministry. and do sound budgeting on a debt sustainable basis. We can teach you how to do a central bank and how to live in a world of exchange rates that are volatile and that aren't manipulated by the Chinas of the world. And we can tell the United States, get rid of your twin deficits so as to get rid of the global imbalances. And if there's a third area that's coming, and it's only the third, in this world of private capital, the lesson of the Asian crisis is not that the free flow of capital was bad, but that nobody had the regulatory or supervisory capacity to know whether it was going towards crony capitalism or productive purposes. We can teach people how to build a regulatory framework for the financial sector so as to steer money towards productive investments rather than hot capital. And that's all we do. And we do it well, and we're focused, and we enjoy the support of 185 members for it. Nobody's borrowing because, frankly, they're taking IMF advice earlier and more often. Those who in public will criticize are actually seeking more and more IMF missions on a private basis to get their advice. So there's a tremendously constructive engagement rather than a hostile engagement. Finally, on ECOSOC and overall coordination, you're right, the world is not perfect. We don't have a single unified world federalist structure. We are living in a world where people have different pieces of the puzzle, as you said, very limited purposes. So the WTO has one corner, Bank and the Fund and the regional banks another corner. We have regional customs unions and free trade areas and so on. The UN family in and of itself couldn't get its act together. So Kofi Annan, before departure, have to appoint an external commission to say, how do we coordinate even within New York on foreign aid? They came out with a recommendation, said, how about one UN? And our dear friends in New York have failed to act on that yet. So you still have UNCTAD versus UNDP versus UNICEF versus WHO and so on. That's the first order of business, which is to get bureaucrats organized. That's not the fault of governments. That's not the fault of superpowers. That's the inertia of international bureaucracies. Then you can begin to look at how to bridge New York with Washington, with Geneva, with some of the regional anchors of power. I'm still hopeful. There's at least one international organization that was very consciously disbanded, which was the International Tin Council, which was meant to be a cartel for the developing world, and it failed. Because global competition actually worked better than any commodity fund.
I think Alda was referring to voluntary.
That was actually.
Well, I think that's a as good a defense of the existing order as the adaptation of it as can be made, but I think it understates the seriousness of the issues. You can have the Monterey Agreement on general principles, but as they're finding in the Doha negotiations and in the negotiations on a more limited basis of the free trade agreements with Peru and Colombia and Panama, it's quite a different thing when you get down to the nuts and bolts, because you have very different conceptions. The issue of core worker rights, you can agree on core worker rights in the ILO. 148 countries agreed on the Declaration on Core Worker Rights, the 1998 Declaration on the Right to Work. But it's quite another thing when you try and negotiate that in the context of the trade agreements, which is the impasse now in the Peru and Colombia cases. We talk about the agricultural issue in Doha. As I said, behind the agricultural issue is the fundamental, more fundamental issue of political and social stability in the rural sector. But they haven't even got to the worker rights issue, which in the latest Trade Promotion Authority enacted in 2002 said that the U.S. negotiators were to make that a priority order, and they can't even get an agreement to talk about that in the WTO. Can't even establish a working group to even to begin to talk about it. So I think the disagreements, as I say, when you as the international system impinges more and more upon issues which have formerly been previously been considered to be subjects of domestic negotiation, as the domestic social compact is imperiled through the back door of globalization, as is the case with respect to such basic issues as the most important global freedom of association and collective bargaining, you're getting a push back. And we haven't reached any equilibrium point at this point. That's why it seems to be such chaos. That's why by Friday we'll know whether or not they're able to pull the rabbit out of the hat in the Doha negotiations, whether they're able to get an agreement on Peru and Colombia, just as illustrative of the degree to which the tensions and the pushback is now assuming, is bringing the system, I would say, to an impasse. It's not only that they aren't borrowing because they're taking IMF advice, but they aren't borrowing because Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay are selling every piece of soya that they can to China, building up the biggest trade surpluses in their history, which has enabled them to pay off the IMF and World Bank, and they don't need to borrow. The East Asian countries were so traumatized by what happened in the crises of the 90s that they're building up enormous financial surpluses so that they will be self-insurers in the event there is another financial crisis, that they don't have to go back to the IMF and World Bank. So I think that it doesn't do us any good to pretend that we aren't at something of a crisis point, a crossroads, as to where we go with these institutions and with these concepts. As far as a consensus on development, those development, I see exactly the opposite. And I think it's a healthy development. Instead of that uniformity trying to be imposed by the Washington consensus, now we have countries which are different, give different weights to equity, to efficiency, to public, to private sector development. Let a thousand flowers bloom, rather than trying to impose the sickle model, which they tried to do in the 80s and the 90s. But that does raise an issue as to whether governance is even a proper term to describe. What we really have is different values expressed in different countries and different priorities, and can this still in the state-centered system, can it be reconciled with this impingement of the international system through these organizations on the domestic questions?
Thank you. I want to make sure we move on to some of the other questions. Because it seems that there are two issues which have been implicit in a number of what comments people have made that we have to bring up. One is the question of whether we have all the organizations that we need. Chagun had said he thought we could reform the institutions that we have are capable of adapting in the ways that are needed to meet the challenges that we have. But implicit, and certainly in some of the other comments, has been a sense that maybe there's some gaps, that we're not capable, and the institutions maybe are not elastic enough to stretch to all the problems that we need. The other one is a sense, at least in some people, that intergovernmental organizations themselves are problematic, that there are other actors that need to be brought into the system in some way. So that the next question is, how do we do that? How do we bring in non-state actors, for want of a better word? And so let me put both those questions on the table. Of what other institutions do we need, and how do we bring in all the actors?
Well, I can start off again by just modifying the question, because it's not institutions or none. It's a spectrum. Sometimes you can get things done with networks. Anne-Marie Slaughter at Princeton has done quite a bit of writing on this. I think our recent experiences you started us off with on avian flu and on SARS suggests that if you get like-minded specialists together for a particular purpose, you don't have to build bricks and mortar. So, too, there's a wonderful, if you go onto the IMF website, there's actually a guide to the Gs, it's called. G3, G5, G7, G10, G24, G77, and so on. don't just think of the G7 as some secret cabal. The various Gs for various purposes, you referred to the trade G20 as distinct from the finance G20. They actually get things done, and they don't build a big institution or an international bureaucracy, which is part of why I said at the outset we're in a world that's intergovernmental rather than supranational. So I'll just start off with that.
I suspect you have something to...
Yeah, I suppose my one most general feeling is about the discussion is that it's very much tended towards the area of economics and development. And I think that that has presupposed a kind of a relatively optimistic view, even recognizing, along with what Professor Levinson is saying, that we may be at some sort of crisis and there's different approaches to economic development and some of these things aren't resolved. But I think if we step back from that and we look at sort of de novo the system without being so biased by what's taken place over the last 20 years and say, is it capable of solving the most essential problems of this new millennium, which I would talk about as conflict prevention and environmental problems, not to discount what I think it's been relatively good at, actually, which is in the field of economic development. Then I'm much more concerned. It seems that we are really within this, basically, if it's true, Jonathan, that we are stuck in a basically sovereignty-based system for the foreseeable future without much modification, then I think there's a lot of reason for great concern. And we have a lot of history ever since Westphalia with the sovereignty system that seems to be continually recurring towards war, seems to be based on, you know, this isn't new ideology, based on balance of power, and when balances of power start to break down, they do tend towards war, and there's a lot of movement in the system right now. It's extremely fluid with China's rise and so forth. It looks like there's tremendous tensions within the interstate system, and of course now we have this new problem of non-state actors that can get access potentially to very, very destructive technologies. And that, just as an aside, goes back to what I meant about people feeling powerless. I didn't mean that coalitions of different developing states and so forth are necessarily completely powerless within the system. I meant that there's huge segments of societies that feel extremely powerless. And obviously, with the most prominence right now, it's certain segments of the Islamic world, citizens within the Islamic world, that don't feel like they're a part of things, that feel like the only way that they can get heard is through violence and so forth. So I think that I would like to see us address more directly this whole issue of conflict prevention and environmental degradation. And to me, the way to begin to get out of this balance of power of states using force and so forth, and also include citizens more in the decision-making and make people feel more like they're part of the system in the way that people do in developed democracies such as our own, where we've had a relatively small amount of homegrown terrorism. And you're never going to convince every Timothy McVeigh, you know, not to commit terrorism, but we do have a system here where we say, if you care enough to organize, if you care enough to protest, there's a legitimate route in the system. There's a way that you can be brought in to the system. And I think we need to work on those things internationally. And I think by beginning to create institutions which bring people in more directly in the international system, we can also begin to circumvent nation states more and more. And I think that the core to a lot of the problems is sovereignty. That's the essential core, that sovereign states basically have created a voluntarist international legal system where they cooperate if they feel like it. They don't cooperate if they don't feel like it. It has all sorts of free rider types of problems. And that if you can begin to create a system which transcends the states and goes right to the citizens, as our own Federalists realized in the United States when they went from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, that then there's the possibility to begin to create a more seamless kind of democratic system where states no longer have the ability, because they don't totally control the legal obligations of their citizens anymore. They're connected at a broader international level where they're involved in global politics. They lose the ability to, with impunity basically, violate international law. And I guess I'll just conclude by saying, I think, you know, this is the insight. I think this is some of what Anne-Marie's getting at with her networking. I think the last Secretary General was very much trying to do this with his global compact, where he realized, it was reported that Mr. Annan used to be out 3 or 4 nights a week going to parties in New York when he was in town. And, you know, I don't think that he was a real party animal and that he just had such a craving to be around people. I think that more what it was that he realized that by beginning to create these connections with the business elite, with key actors in civil society and so forth, that it was a way to begin to give himself a little bit more room to maneuver, that he didn't have just dealing with the diplomatic representatives in Washington. If he could go to the press, if he could go to different organizations and so forth, it gave him more room. So I think that's the kind of thing, and of course, as Danny suggested at the beginning, my own point of departure has been to try and think about beginning to create some sort of parliamentary model based on the European Parliament, where you might have a group of, say, 20 to 30 countries agree on a treaty for an advisory parliament in the early